You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. And joining me in the studio today is literary critic and author Amanda Craig. Today we'll be discussing The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry, a romantic historical novel that explores the battle between science and religion in 19th century England, and a memoir by the writer Elena Lapin, which uncovers her ancestry through language. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll be hearing from the writer and filmmaker Hannah Rothschild about her latest novel, The Improbability of Love. All that coming up on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Stay tuned. Our first book today is The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry. At its core, this is a love story, but being set in the 1890s, it also depicts a historical period of intense religious and scientific debate. Through the protagonist, Cora Seaborn, the novel pits science against superstition and atheism against religion. Amanda, welcome to the show. First off, who is Cora and where do we first encounter her?
Well, we first encounter her when her husband, who's a statesman, is dying. And she is much younger than he is. She's got one son. And we gather that this marriage has not just been unhappy, but positively abusive. So it's a great relief to her when this man dies. And as a result of this, the doctor, meanwhile, has fallen in love with her. She's a very mercurial, bewitching character. One of the great strengths of this novel is how interesting all the characters are, how intelligent and sensitive and unexpected they are. Anyway, she's also a kind of amateur naturalist and geologist. She's very interested in fossils. And as a result of this widowhood, which sets her free, she goes off to Essex, where there's a rumour of serpent that might possibly be a dinosaur. You're for a long, long time, you're not sure quite what it is. So it's got a lot of suspense, this book.
And does she go out to Essex looking for this, or is it something that she finds out once she's there?
I think she goes out looking for it. She hears some rumours. She's quite well educated. Not, of course, as a Victorian lady would be. Not in a school, but by her father and just her own reading, and she's just full of intellectual curiosity, and she meets there is a sort of a love triangle, because this doctor who's interested in her follows her out there, but she also meets a very attractive and thoughtful but married man called Will, who is religious. He's a local vicar. So part of this novel is not only the emotional trajectory between these two people, but also the debate between science and religion.
And it does sound quite kind of cerebral at times when these two characters are kind of discussing religion and superstition. Mm. Does it feel philosophical, or I mean, is it tread quite
well,
lightly?
It's the most delightful book. I mean, you could say it's the book that it reminded me most of in some ways is A.S. Byatt's Possession. It's got that complete ease with the Victorian era, but it's not at all ponderous. It's not at all preachy or over-researched. It just feels completely natural that these two people should be talking about this subject that, of course, was electrifying everybody, you know, Darwinism and evolution. And did that mean that God didn't exist? Or the world, the universe was a whole lot older than anybody had thought. But they're also two people who are passionate and suffering. I mean, this man has got a dying wife and several children. So it's full of moral dilemma.
I mean, here we have a naturalist who's left London for Essex dealing with a superstitious community. In Perry's first book, After Me Comes the Flood, a man also leaves London and comes across a dilapidated house where a former preacher lives, haunted by the Bible. Why do you think these subjects kind of obsess Perry so much? And is there this, you know, this idea of leaving the city and going into the sort of rural countryside? Mm. What do you think that means for her?
Well, I gather that she herself grew up in a very religious household. So there is obviously, it's absolutely part of her imagination. And she's obviously also very deeply rooted in East Anglia. and the Essex countryside. But I think she's someone who's utterly fascinating. I mean, you would have to read this novel to see its peculiar charm and intensity. It's in some ways very old-fashioned. I mean, we're not used to reading books about religion anymore, or people being religious. And actually, it makes you realise how impoverished we are not having this in our daily consciousness. Because, you know, for these characters, it really does matter that, you know, there is a God or there isn't a God, that, you know, what you do is, you know, seen by the Almighty, or the Almighty doesn't exist. And, of course, the Essex serpent of the title is not only, you know, possibly a real life dinosaur, as you start to hope, but it's also the serpent of the Bible, and, you know, the loss of innocence and corruption and so on. So it's full of ideas, this book, but what keeps it going is the beautiful, intense style in which it's written. It's just saturated with lovely descriptions of landscape and people's feelings and character. And it just really sort of carries you along in this sinuous, serpentine way, which is very satisfying. It's very unusual, this book, but I think a lot of people will enjoy it.
The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry is out tomorrow, published by Serpent's Tale. Next today, we have the memoir of the writer Eleanor Lapin, who uses the genre to explore her identity through language and ancestry. Lapin is Russian by birth, but has lived in Czechoslovakia, Germany, Israel, Canada, the United States, and now resides in London. She was intrigued by her own choice to become a writer in English and sets out on a journey to uncover her past in order to find an explanation. Amanda, what sort of a journey does Lapin go on here?
Well, it's partly a straight autobiographical journey of all the different countries that she and her parents lived in her childhood and young womanhood. But it's also, I suppose, a journey of a more philosophical kind about what does learning a different language, thinking in a different language, reading, writing, explaining, teaching and working in different languages do to us? You know, how does it change what we're trying to say or what we're trying to become? She says towards the end of the book that in a sense this is a story of five languages in search of an author. This could be a very sad book, because as she says, you know, you lose something when you lose your mother tongue, when it's not the tongue that, say, your children speak, or that your children can speak to their grandparents in. You know, this is very much an experience of displacement, which is very topical. But she is someone who is not an immigrant. She's not an asylum seeker. She's not a migrant. She is something that used to be called an émigré, that someone who actually was able to get out of a country, in this case, originally Soviet Russia, and then communist Czechoslovakia, and make a life, even if you started with absolutely nothing. I mean, it's a very compelling story, even without the twist that the man she has grown up thinking was her father turns out not to be.
Wow.
Turns out to be, you know, a CIA agent. So there are real kind of rather novelistic twists in this. What it reminds me of somewhat are those children's books that came out of the Second World War, things like When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit and The Silver Sword, because it's very much a story of how, with this tremendous warmth and positive spirit, a family and an individual can survive what seems like the most devastating blows, you know, the loss of a home, the loss of all your friends, the loss of your school, the loss of your language. And it's a very warm book. It's full of love and enthusiasm and joy. And I think it would basically cheer anyone up to read this. We're so gloomy a lot of the time about all these poor people who have lost their homes all over the world. This is a story of success and triumph over quite considerable adversity.
And how much does she go into each of the kind of country's political situations? I mean, are we seeing this with a historical viewpoint, or is it the viewpoint of a young child in many ways?
No. She's terribly good at bringing the personal and the political together, so that her mother, for instance, who's a very young mother, is able to get away with having, I think it's a Czech husband, because she tells the university that she is a single mother. And in Soviet Russia, that's terrifically acceptable, unlike anywhere else. So she, and then of course she's a teenager when there's the Prague Spring comes along, and she also experiences anti-Semitism in post-war Germany. And she writes about this with, not with anger, but with such compassion. And you know, she of course anti-Semitism is a horrific thing, but she kind of understands where some of this stuff is coming from.
And I wanted to come back to obviously language, which is central to the book. We mentioned that she was fascinated by her decision to choose English as the language she wanted to become a writer in. Does she give us any clues as to why she thinks that was? I mean, does English allow her to express certain things that maybe she can't in other languages? What's the sort of the rationale she gives there?
It's slightly mysterious, because when she tells you about the books that she read and the early stuff that she wrote in Czech, you realise that there is this whole world of playfulness that is complete, you know, is largely lacking in English, rather sadly. She refers a bit to Nabokov, who's the other great person who wrote about, you know, what it was like to not be able to write in Russian anymore and being right to writing in English. But she's got both an academic interest in the different grammar of, I mean, this makes it sound boring, but it's not, of different languages, and this very vital, humane feeling for English. You know, she understood that this was the language that was going to set her free. Her own brother, in fact, is a very distinguished German author. He chose a different language and a different path. So I think anyone who has any foreign relations would find this really quite fascinating. You know, what makes us who we are, both consciously and unconsciously? Do we dream in a language, or do we only dream in images and feelings? So it's something that sounds quite playful, but it's quite profound about identity and how much is bound up with where we come from and what language we speak.
What Language Do I Dream In? By Elena Lapin is out on June 7th, published by Virago. Amanda Craig, thanks very much for joining us. Now we're going to take a sneak peek at this weekend's Meet the Writers. This week, Georgina Godwin meets Hannah Rothschild, the writer, documentary maker and a company director. She also serves on boards of various philanthropic trusts and museums, including chairing Britain's National Gallery. She's published a biography, The Baroness, and her first novel, The Improbability of Love, has just been shortlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, and has, just this week, won the 2016 Bollinger Everyman Woodhouse Prize. Here's Georgina and Hannah on her latest novel.
I had hope, funnily enough, having done these documentaries and having written the biography, that I could be freed completely from fact-checking and you know, from being accurate. Of course, actually, that isn't the case. You still have to be accurate and you still have to fact check, because it's so irritating people when they discover a big mistake, which indeed, you know, I have made big mistakes, you know, in many things I've done. So I wasn't completely freed from facts. But what is exciting about it is that with a biography, you, in a way, you're bound by the person's life or by the events. But in a narrative book, a fictional book, you can kind of go off piste. And indeed, you know, I went shooting, you know, I didn't expect at the beginning that some of the characters that appear in the book were going to appear. It just seemed like a good moment when I went, oh, that would be fun. I wonder what that person might be like. And the book at first was a very, very unwieldy kind of 1,000 pages. I'm happy to say it's been kind of heavily cut down. But I think the next time I write, I'll have more of a kind of roadmap about where to go.
At least one of the characters was based on a real person.
Yes, I don't think he minds me saying this. So I made a film about Nicky Haslam, who is a kind of, he's more than a decorator. He's someone who, firstly, he's a fantastically funny, amusing, interesting person. And I wanted to make a film about him because, in a way, I wanted to understand society through his eyes, because he's very much part of society. You know, he was son of an earl. His mother was Queen Victoria's goddaughter. You know, he's very much part of that whole world. And I quite wanted to understand what that world was through his eyes. Anyway, and he's a real bon vivant. What he does is that, in theory, he goes in and tells people how to decorate their houses. But actually, in practice, he does a lot more than that. He almost gives them a life. He kind of says, this is what you should wear, and this is where you should eat, and this should be your hobbies. Because many people are coming from foreign countries. They don't know how England works. Of course, he does. So I just thought, well, actually, he's so much part of the fabric of English life. Why not put a character inspired by him in the book?
Now, the fictional protagonist is a chef, and she makes a magnificent feast based on a painting. There are some wonderful foodie gems in the book that just cry out for more investigation, like the On Honourable Pleasure and Health, recipes collated in 1465.
Well, listen, if you're a procrastinator, which I am, afraid, and if, you know, many writers are, because, you know, the actual business of writing is quite a slog. So there's nothing more delicious, frankly, than going researching recipes. So I spent many, many, many hours kind of drooling over cookery books in the London Library and elsewhere. And a lot of the, I mean, actually, it is all absolutely true. Not only that, I then talk about really big procrastination. I then decided to cook some of these recipes myself to see whether they worked. Now, I'm not a good cook. I'm a grade A eater, but I'm not a very good cook. So it took, A, you know, many, 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 many times too long to make them. And the results were pretty foul, frankly. But I thought I might as well give it a go.
That was Hannah Rothschild speaking to Georgina Godwin for this weekend's edition of Meet the Writers. Hear the full conversation on Saturday at 1500 London time. That brings us to the end of today's show, I'm afraid. Thanks very much to my guest, Amanda Craig. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when Tim Roby will join Steve Bloomfield in the studio for this week's film review. But for now, goodbye from me and thanks very much for tuning in.